fine to indulge from time to time. On the other hand, as an abstainer, I wanted to tell moderators, you can't keep cheating and expect to make progress, or why don't you just go cold turkey? But there's no one right way. Different approaches work for different people. Exception, with an actual addiction, such as to alcohol or cigarettes, abstaining is generally the only solution. And in general, abstaining from alcohol helps people maintain their self-control, whether about diet, anger, spending, or anything else. A well-meaning friend once admonished me, "Life's too short to miss the chance to eat a brownie." Spoken like a true moderator. No, I shook my head. For me, life is too short to let something like a brownie weigh on my mind. It makes me happier not to eat it. "I really don't think that attitude is healthy," she said. "You're too extreme." "Very likely," I said with a laugh, "but it works for me." She might disapprove, but I knew myself. And so I skipped all the holiday treats. I didn't eat a single piece of the candy we bought to decorate the graham cracker houses. I didn't have even one bite of the freshly baked gingerbread cookies, or the raw cookie dough, which I found even more tempting, or the gorgeous towering croquembouche that my mother bought for Christmas Eve dinner, or the chocolate chip biscotti that Jamie baked, or the family-sized skyscraper ice cream soda at Winstead's. I ate anything else I wanted, but not sweets. And it was such a tremendous relief. This approach wouldn't work for everyone, but it suited my nature. By giving myself limits, I give myself freedom. Convenience. I also employed the weapon of convenience by making it easy to behave the way I wanted to behave. The startling research discussed in Brian Wansink's Mindless Eating demonstrates the degree to which convenience influences what we eat. We're far more likely to indulge in a tempting food when we can easily see and reach it. In one study, when chocolates on a secretary's desk became more visible after they were moved from an opaque to a clear bowl, consumption rose by 46%. On the other hand, ice cream consumption dropped in half after a cafeteria merely closed the lid of the cooler. To help me abstain, I wrapped holiday goodies in tinfoil and stowed them on a high shelf. Once they were out of sight, I forgot they were there. Jamie retrieved desserts for Eliza and Eleanor. Along the same lines, at a holiday party, I stood far away from the desserts-laden table. Inconvenience as a replacement for self-control works outside the context of food, too. Some people freeze their credit cards in a pan of water to make it very tough to use them. Conversely, convenience can also help push us to take positive action. A friend moved his stationary bike in front of the TV. Now, when he's watching TV, he just hops on the bike. Another friend found it easier to take long walks after she got a dog. In fact, one study showed that dog owners get more exercise and enjoy it more than people who go to a gym. 70% of long-term gym memberships are mostly unused, but a dog needs walking every day. When we were on vacation, I often put on my gym clothes as soon as I got up in the morning to make it easier to get myself to the gym. By lessening my dependence on self-control, abstinence and convenience strengthened my self-mastery. Self-mastery. So many of my resolutions came from my desire to gain more self-knowledge and self-control. The hardest victory is over myself. On the last day of December, when we were back in New York City, I ran into an acquaintance on the street. We chatted for a few minutes, and I thought, wow, this guy's a happiness leech for sure. I'd forgotten what a grouch he is. He was polite, but I could feel his negativity wash over me. Every time he said something downbeat, I found myself countering with something cheery. Uncharacteristically cheery. "I'm just so relieved that the holidays are almost over," he said. "Really? I love the holidays," I said. "I hate the crowds and the commercialism," he observed. I love the festivity, I countered. This went on for several minutes, and after we said goodbye, I asked myself, what was that chirpy, albeit combative, persona I'd suddenly adopted? I hardly recognized myself. Preoccupied with our conversation, I continued down the street, and suddenly I glimpsed a pattern that I'd never quite seen before. Once I recognized it, it seemed obvious, but as one of my secrets of adulthood holds, it's enormously helpful and surprisingly difficult to grasp the obvious. This is the pattern. Tiggers emerge in contrast to Eeyores, and Eeyores emerge in contrast to Tiggers. In A.A. Milne's classic children's story, Winnie the Pooh, Tigger is the stubbornly optimistic, energetic tiger, and Eeyore is the persistently gloomy, pessimistic donkey. The reference is decidedly twee, but no other pair of well-known literary characters embodies this tension so perfectly. In other words, people of pronounced positivity or negativity may polarize each other. Our emotions don't exist in isolation. And while it's clear that happy people lift people's spirits and that unhappy people spread their downbeat moods, I now realize that people can also spread the opposite emotion. Why? Because the Tiggers and the Eeyores sometimes engage in an emotional tug-of-war, the kind that I just experienced on that street corner. When Tiggers and Eeyores meet, Tiggers become ever more insistently cheery, and Eeyores become more negative, to resist each other's influence. In a frustrating cycle, they oppose and exhaust each other. As Tiggers insist, hey, it's not that bad, or look on the bright side, Eeyores insist even more emphatically on the correctness of their gloomier attitudes. The more Eeyores say, it's best to be prepared for the worst, and you're not facing reality, the more frantically Tiggers act as cheerleaders. So how can Tiggers and Eeyores cope with each other, and how might I have responded more constructively to my Eeyore acquaintance? Acknowledging someone else's point of view, without trying to correct or deny it, slackens the tension, and in any event, it's rare for either side to make a convert. Tiggers and Eeyores alike are proud of their identities. They aren't going to be talked out of their positions. I noticed something further. Eeyore types often criticize the fakeness of extreme Tiggers, and they're exasperated by this Panglossian refusal to acknowledge the dark side of life, to mix literary metaphors. But when I reflected about people I've known who might be considered extreme Tiggers, I saw a common thread. Many of them were facing a major happiness challenge in their lives. I suspect that just as Tiggers and Eeyores try to counterbalance each other, Tiggers who seem to be trying very hard to stay positive, no matter what, are resisting being dragged down completely by someone or something. When I posted on my blog about the Tigger versus Eeyore dynamic, many readers responded with their own experiences. One wrote, I am not overly cheery, and good friends would not describe me as so, but to my mother-in-law's Eeyore, I am a major Tigger, and I'm sure I must make her as crazy as she makes me. Interesting to think of my own part in our shaky relationship. Another wrote, this dynamic actually becomes a huge source of guilt in my daily life. As a Tigger, I absolutely dread spending time with some of the negative people in my life. Unfortunately, some of the most negative people in my life happen to be close to me. My parents, for example. When we spend time together, it goes something like this. Mom, my life is terrible. I'm such a victim. Me, why don't you try having coffee with a friend, getting some exercise, trying a new hobby, etc. Mom, that will never work because... Me, maybe it's not so bad. Mom, oh, it is that bad. It's so frustrating. Another wrote, I purposely try to be a Tigger as much as possible, and when life is going well, I am flying on the clouds. However, my girlfriend is happy and optimistic sometimes, but usually sad, depressed, and realistic about everything wrong. We're in college, so classes and money tend to be the main things. If I come home and she's depressed, I try to be more bubbly and happy and try to get her to be active rather than sitting on the couch and playing computer games. I always thought this would help, but it usually exhausts me and brings me down without doing much for her. From now on, I will calm down and continue on my way and let her come out of it on her own. Another wrote, I have a Tigger-type friend. She is incessantly upbeat, to the point that I avoid her at times. But then, after reading what you said here, I remember that her husband is fakely cheerful, but underneath, very pessimistic and negative, remote and cold even. Maybe she's being so cheerful to counteract him. Since I rarely see her without him around, maybe I don't get a chance to see a more balanced person? As I saw the Tigger-Eeyore phenomenon more clearly, my already strong urge to be a happiness bully became almost irresistible. I had to bite my tongue not to give little helpful lectures. Hey, Tigger, remember the seventh splendid truth. You can't make someone be happy. Let your happiness naturally rub off on the Eeyores, but don't exhaust yourself trying to jolly them along. Telling Eeyores to cheer up doesn't make them happier. It drives them nuts. Hey, Eeyore, remember, you think you're being realistic and honest, but others may find you gloomy and critical. And if being around you is a downer, they'll want to avoid you. Whether or not this should be true, it is true. And while you think some Tiggers are fake, their extreme cheerfulness may be in reaction to you. Yes, you may be inciting the very Tiggerness that's making you crazy. As I resisted the urge to scold the Tiggers and Eeyores I encountered, I recalled Thoreau's admonition. Let everyone mind his own business and endeavor to be what he was made. Be Gretchen. That was work enough. The month of January. Time. Cram my day with what I love. One lives in the naive notion that later there will be more room than in the entire past. Elias Canetti, The Human Province. Resolutions. Control the cubicle in my pocket. Guard my children's free time. Suffer for 15 minutes. Go on monthly adventures with Jamie. In September, the start of the school year had inspired me to start a happiness project, and now in January, the new calendar year gave me a fresh burst of resolution-keeping zeal. But along with keeping my monthly resolutions, I wanted to experiment with an additional strategy, to choose a single word or phrase as an overarching theme for the entire year. I lifted the idea from my sister Elizabeth. One year her theme was free time. Another year was Hot Wheels, which was the year she bought a car and started driving. A friend does the same thing. One year he chose dark, one year fame. I knew exactly which word to choose as my theme for the year. Bigger. As I fought the urge to simplify, to keep things small and manageable, bigger would challenge me to think big, to tolerate complications and failure, to expect more from myself. I wanted to choose the bigger life. When I posted on my blog about my one-word theme, readers added their own thought-provoking choices. Renewal. Habit. Play. Healthy. Action. Possibility. Believe. Move. Enough. Details. Serve. Generous. Upgrade. Boundaries. Love. Finish. Answers. Adventure. Forbearance. Create. Dive. Reach. Open. Slower. Flare. As I scrolled through the responses, I noticed that Elizabeth had posted on my blog. I always got a big kick out of seeing her name in the comments, and she chose smaller. The opposite of a profound truth is also true. Bigger was my theme for the new year. and back within the familiar monthly frame of my happiness project for January, as I faced the fresh, unbroken snow of the new year, I wanted to think about time. A feeling of control is a very important aspect of happiness. People who feel in control of their lives, which is powerfully bolstered by feeling in control of time, are more likely to feel happy. I'd loved the unhurriedness of Kansas City. Our days were full of activities, but without any sense of urgency. I didn't have to race around doing 10 things at once. I didn't have to press the girls or myself to finish their breakfasts or to put on their coats in a rush. I set my own pace. I actually completed whatever I set out to do on a particular day. In January, I wanted to cultivate this atmosphere of unhurriedness at home. I wanted plenty of time to get to where I needed to go, to do the things that I wanted to do, with little time wasted on unsatisfying activities. "I love a broad margin to my life," wrote Thoreau, "and that's what I wanted to build. Below the energetic bustle on the surface of our lives, I wanted to cultivate an abiding sense of repose." This wasn't easy for me. I was always trying to blast through my to-do items. For instance, on mornings when he went to work on the later side, Jamie would sometimes come into Eleanor's room as I was prodding her to get dressed and announce, "Okay, Enno, I'm leaving for work now. Come give me a kiss." This was hilarious to Eleanor, because he would be wearing nothing but his boxer shorts, or he would be dressed in his suit, but with bare feet. I got annoyed with this familiar exchange because it interrupted our march through the morning checklist, until I finally realized that we have plenty of time to get to school, and it's nice to start the day with some goofiness. I stopped trying to hustle them along. Many aspects of my life contributed to my feeling of hurry. Time might seem to be a very separate issue from possessions, for example, but I'd noticed that after I tackled clutter, not only did our apartment seem more spacious and organized, I also felt less hurried because I could find and stow things easily. Having more order in my cabinets and closets made me feel as though I had more time in my day. Instead of scrabbling away at high shelves in search of a flashlight or jamming the heating pad into some odd corner, I had a place for everything, with nothing superfluous in my way, which gave me a feeling of unhurriedness and mastery of the space around me. I often felt as if I were jumping, or being dragged, from one task to another. Various devices rang, buzzed, or chimed in my direction, and while technology often interrupted me, those rackety devices weren't the only things clamoring for my attention. Of everything, the disruption I found most harassing? When my daughters both talked to me at the same time. When I felt hurried and distracted, I behaved worse. I nagged Jamie and my daughters more because I wanted to cross things off my list. I became too preoccupied to notice the ordinary pleasures of my day. The colors of the fruit outside Lickitsaka's Market around the corner from my apartment. The nice smell outside the florist shop. Eliza's funny stories about what happened in the lunchroom. I spoke more harshly because I was impatient. I was more likely to be rude to people on the street or in stores, which, it turns out, is true of most people. Psychologist Robert Levine calculated the pace of life in many American cities by considering factors such as walking speed, bank teller speed, and speed of speech, and he found that the more hurried the pace of life, the less helpful people were apt to be. They were less likely to perform courtesies, such as returning a pen that a researcher accidentally dropped or giving change for a quarter. New York City ranked as the third fastest city, after Boston and Buffalo, and the least helpful. But as rushed as I felt, I could take the time for courtesy. Feeling hurried came in at least three flavors for me: treadmill hurry, to-do list hurry, and put out the fires hurry. With treadmill hurry, I felt that I couldn't turn myself off for fear that I'd never catch up. I couldn't stop checking my email over the weekend or take a week's vacation from writing. With to-do list hurry, I felt I had to race around and accomplish too many things in too little time. With put out the fires hurry, I felt that I was spending all my time dealing with urgent things instead of doing the things most important to me. I didn't want to slow down, but rather to change the experience of the pace of my life. Speed is not part of the true way of strategy, legendary swordsman Miyamoto Musashi observed in A Book of Five Rings. Speed implies that things seem fast or slow. Of course, slowness is bad. Really skillful people never get out of time and are always deliberate and never appear busy. I wanted a pace of life that was deliberate, that felt neither fast nor slow. Instead, time seemed to be passing so quickly. Where had autumn gone? New York City was getting record amounts of snow, but I couldn't shake the feeling that winter hadn't really started. My sixth grade year seemed to last forever, yet the first semester of Eliza's sixth grade year had passed in a flash. I'm not the only one to feel this effect. As we get older, time seems to pass more quickly. As poet Robert Southey explained, "Live as long as you may, the first 20 years are the longest half of your life. They appear so while they are passing. They seem to have been so when we look back on them, and they take up more room in our memory than all the years that succeed them." Research supports Southey's observation. According to work done in the 1970s by Robert Lemlich, people who live to be 80 years old have passed through 71% of the subjective experience of the passage of time by the time they're 40. The years between ages 60 and 80 feel like just 13% of life. Also, I suffered from the persistent delusion that once I got through the next 3 or 4 months, things would slow down. I'll have more time during the holidays, or after the holidays, or once the summer's here, I'd promise myself over and over. But things never slowed down. If I wanted a feeling of unhurriedness, I would have to create it now. In January, I wanted to lengthen time to make it more rich and vivid. But how? When an experience is new or challenging, and we must absorb more information, time seems to pass more slowly. When one day blurs indistinguishably from the last, the months evaporate. So I could slow time by making a radical change in my life, move to a new city, or even better, a new country, or switch careers, or have a baby. But I didn't want to make a radical change. I'd have to find other ways. This month, I also wanted to make sure that my time reflected my values. Too often, I reacted to other people and circumstances instead of setting my own priorities. Elizabeth often quoted the line, "Your lack of planning is not my emergency." "The thing is," a friend said, "I don't have any free time. I need to spend time with my kids, and I have things to get done at home, but I'm at work all day, and I bring work home. There's just not enough time." "I know," I said, nodding. "Sometimes I'm so overwhelmed with all the things I can't possibly accomplish that I get paralyzed and end up leafing through some magazine I've already read because I can't figure out where to start." "So what's the solution?" she asked. "I can't do all the things I want to do. I just don't have enough time." I'd often said similar things to myself, but no more. For January, I decided to stop making the excuse, "I don't have time to do that." I do have time, if I make time for the things that are important to me. Among my most fundamental uses of time, sleep and exercise. If I want to feel cheerful, energetic, and mentally sharp, I have to get enough sleep, even if that means leaving emails unread or putting down a book in mid-chapter. Sleep deprivation affects the memory, causes irritability, depresses the immune system, and may even contribute to weight gain, and a couple's sleep quality affects the quality of their relationship. Although chronically sleep-deprived people believe they're functioning fine, their mental acuity is actually quite impaired. And while many people claim they need only 5 or 6 hours of sleep, just 1 to 3% of the population thrives on so little sleep. These true short sleepers stay up late and get up very early, and they don't rely on naps, caffeine, or weekend sleep binges. I have no illusion of being a short sleeper. I'm definitely a long sleeper. Similarly, Exercise is terrifically important for good health. Plus, I knew that I felt happier, at once more calm and more energetic, when I went to the gym regularly. Also, living in New York City, I do a fair amount of walking in my average day. I clock a mile just making the round-trip walk to the girls' school. I never push myself to exercise hard, but just to exercise at all. Many years ago, my father, a dedicated exerciser, helped convert me from my previous couch potato ways by reassuring me, "All you have to do is put on your running shoes and shut the front door behind you." Whatever new resolutions I might make for the month, sleep and exercise would remain unshakable priorities. For January's resolutions, first, I vowed to control the cubicle in my pocket to gain better control of my time. Also, as a parent, I had great influence not only over my own use of time, but also my children's time. And after a lengthy internal debate, I stuck to a different time-related resolution to guard my children's free time. Because I knew I'd be happier if I made time to tackle the chores I dreaded, I vowed to suffer for 15 minutes each day on a long postponed task. This would be an unenjoyable resolution, but after all, happiness doesn't always make me feel happy. At the same time, I wanted to find more time to have fun with Jamie, so I'd ask him to go on monthly adventures together. Control the cubicle in my pocket. Managing time is a pervasive, widespread struggle. Like many people, I walk around with a cubicle in my pocket, a relentless call to work. A lawyer friend told me, I quit the work-life balance committee at my firm. When they asked me why, I said, my work-life balance requires that I go to fewer meetings. They were not amused. I've heard dozens of suggestions about how to get better control of my time, but I didn't want to weigh the merits of multitasking or organize my emails according to priority or download an app to get better organized. I needed to think bigger. Bigger! I always have the feeling that I should be working. I always feel pressed for time, as if someone were shoving a pistol in my back and muttering, "Move, move, move!" I should start that new chapter. I should work through my notes on that book. I should look up that reference. I'm lucky. I love all this work, and I look forward to working. But my feeling that I should be working, or my choice to work instead of doing other things that are also important, sometimes interferes with my long-term happiness. Because I feel this perpetual pull toward my desk, there has always been a tension between my work and other parts of my life. But technology has greatly exacerbated it for two reasons. First, technology allows me to work anywhere. When I was clerking, by contrast, leaving the office meant leaving work behind. Justice O'Connor certainly never called me at home. Nowadays, writing is something, usually for better, but sometimes for worse, that I can do any place. So being at home doesn't provide the same feeling of contrast or refuge. It's wonderful to have a schedule free from time-wasting meetings or a long commute. Commuting, highly correlated with stress and social isolation, is a major source of unhappiness. And I love working, and I love being able to wear yoga pants practically every day of my life. But on the other hand, my laptop travels everywhere with me. As Frank Lloyd Wright said, "Where I am, there my office is. My office, me." 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, including holidays. Also, technology has created new kinds of work that seem to demand constant, immediate attention. I should answer my emails. I should look at that link. I should check Facebook and Twitter. When I interviewed personal finance expert Manisha Thakur, she gruesomely observed, "The internet is both my lifeline and the plastic bag over my head." What's more, these kinds of online tasks give me an easy way to be fake productive. One of my secrets of adulthood? Working is one of the most dangerous forms of procrastination. "I'm so distracted all the time," a friend declared. "My attention jumps from my kids to office politics to the news. I'm not giving my real attention to anything. I can never do any real thinking." I don't feel distracted. I feel hunted, another friend protested. There's always something to read or answer. 10 years ago, my coworkers didn't call me on the weekends, so why do we email back and forth at 10 p.m. on Saturday nights? Different people use different solutions to control the cubicle in their pockets. I loved one friend's strategy. The footer of her emails reads, "Please note, this inbox does not appreciate long emails." Some people, whether religious or not, observe a technology Sabbath. No emails, no calls, no checking the internet. I don't even read nonfiction, a writer friend told me. Novels only. One friend has two Blackberries, one for work emails, one for personal emails. I just couldn't manage it when all the emails came together, she explained. Another doesn't read email or answer the phone for the first 2 hours of the day, so he can use that time to work on his priority items. Another friend managed to stay off email during a week's vacation by not allowing herself to recharge her cell phone. One friend told me he didn't answer email on the weekend. But on Monday morning, how do you face the huge buildup you've accumulated? I asked. I check my email constantly just to stay on top of it. That's treadmill hurry. One study reported that the average American employee spends 107 minutes on email each day, but I often clocked much more than that. Actually, he confided, I do read and answer email, but my emails don't get sent out until Monday morning. That way, I enforce the expectation that I won't be answering email, and I don't get into back-and-forth exchanges over the weekend. But that means you're still answering emails on the weekend, I pointed out. True, but I don't really mind. This way, I keep the volume lower and answer only at a convenient time. Technology is a good servant, but a bad master, and technology can be used to restrain technology. Some people use computer programs to block their internet access during certain periods, so they have to reboot to get online. A friend working frantically to meet a writing deadline set her email's automatic reply to read, "If this is an urgent matter, please contact my husband at blank." She figured rightly that for a real emergency, people would contact her husband, but they'd think hard before they did. But I knew I shouldn't really blame technology. The real problem wasn't the switch on my computer, but the switch inside my mind. To be more focused, I came up with 8 rules for controlling the cubicle in my pocket. When I'm with my family, I put away my phone, iPad, and laptop. Often, I'm tempted to check email not because I expect any urgent message, but because I'm a bit bored. Standing around in the grocery store while Eliza takes forever to choose the snack to take to the school party, or watching Eleanor finish with maddening precision the 20 flowers she draws at the bottom of every picture. If these devices are around, it's hard for me to resist them, yet nothing is more poignant than seeing a child sit ignored beside a parent who is gazing into a screen. I still get distracted by newspapers, magazines, books, and the mail, but this rule helps. I don't check my email or talk on the phone when I'm traveling from one place to another, whether by foot, bus, subway, or taxi. I used to press myself to use that time efficiently, but then I realized that many of my most important ideas have come to me in these loose moments. As Virginia Woolf noted in her diary, "My mind works in idleness. To do nothing is often my most profitable way." Along the same lines, a friend met her husband when they sat across from each other on a bus. If they'd been busy with their devices, they never would have spoken. Whenever I work at home, I get pulled online to tackle various tasks, so to do the intellectually demanding work of writing, I leave my home office and my 3 beloved computer monitors to work at the wonderful old library that's just a block from my apartment. Instead of trying to resist the siren call of email, Facebook, Twitter, my blog, and the phone, I put them out of reach, another way to abandon my self-control. Also, the atmosphere of a library helps me to think. When I want to take a break, instead of heading to the kitchen for a snack, I wander among the many floors of books. I don't check email at bedtime. I love ending the day with an emptier inbox, but the stimulation of reading emails wakes me right up, and as a consequence, I often have trouble falling asleep. Unless someone is crying, throwing up, or smells smoke, sleep is my first priority. I mute my cell phone. Someone coined the term fusillarm, F-A-U-X-C-E-L-L-A-R-M, to describe the jumpy feeling you get when you imagine that your cell phone is ringing. If possible, I do my heavy writing in the morning. I wasn't surprised to learn that most people work at peak efficiency a few hours after they wake up, for a period of about 4 hours. According to that research, my prime work hours would stretch from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., which is exactly right. However, in violation of the advice of most efficiency experts, who argue that people should work first on their own priorities, I start my day by tackling my email. For a while, I tried to do original writing in the hour between 6 and 7 a.m. when I work at my desk before my family is awake, but I found that I couldn't concentrate until I'd read through my inbox. I embrace the fact that I do a lot of connecting with friends and acquaintances through technology. Although nothing replaces face-to-face meetings, it's better to use those tools than not to connect at all. These steps helped me feel calmer and more focused, but I wondered whether they were making me less productive. I was reassured, therefore, to see research showing that when people were interrupted to respond to email or IM, they needed about 15 minutes to resume a serious mental task. Maintaining a single focus would actually help me work more efficiently. Of course, I was extremely fortunate to have such flexible work. In fact, one of my gratitude exercises was to remind myself how much I loved my work every time I sat down at the computer. Compared to many people, I had enormous control over my time, but that wouldn't do me any good if I didn't use that flexibility to give my life the shape I wanted. In September, when I'd thought about my possessions, I'd realized that I shouldn't focus on having less or having more, but on loving what I had. With time, I thought, I shouldn't focus on doing less or doing more, but doing what I valued. Instead of pursuing the impossible goal of balance, I sought to cram my days with the activities I loved, which also meant making time for rereading, playing, taking notes without a purpose, and wandering. I always had the uncomfortable feeling that if I wasn't sitting in front of a computer typing, I was wasting my time, but I pushed myself to take a wider view of what was productive. Time spent with my family and friends was never wasted. My office was my workplace, but it was also my playground, my backyard, my treehouse. Guard my children's free time. One of the main happiness differences between adults and children is their control of time. Although adults often complain about not being in control of their time, children face a different kind of lack of control. As a parent, I have tremendous influence over what my daughters do with their time when they're home from school. As we were considering Eliza's after-school schedule for the new semester, I felt pulled in different directions. So many classes, so many opportunities. If she wanted, she could learn anything from Chinese to chess to cello. Such activities would be enjoyable and enriching, plus the careerist part of me noted that they'd be useful on future applications and resumes. But what about a lesson Eliza didn't want? For instance, I'd become preoccupied with the idea of piano lessons. If she was ever going to take piano, she should probably start now. But she didn't want to take piano lessons. Should Jamie and I insist? Like many parents, we wanted to give our children every advantage we possibly could. We felt incredibly lucky to be in a position to provide lessons, but that didn't help us decide whether to provide them or impose them. I could muster several arguments for making Eliza take piano lessons. Surely the knowledge of music, the discipline of practice, and the mastery of a skill would enhance her life. We don't have a piano, but Jamie's parents do, and they live right around the corner from us. Right around the corner. It's just 106 steps from our building to their building, Eleanor counted. My mother-in-law Judy is a music nut, and I knew she'd love to have Eliza dropping by their apartment to practice. I raised the piano lesson question with several of my friends. The thing is, if you stick with something long enough, you get good at it, then you enjoy it, a friend argued. Well, I said slowly, thinking, was that really true? And without a parent making you persist, you give up. I hated practicing the violin, so my parents let me quit, and now I really regret it. Do you think that you hate doing something for years, then you love it? I asked. That's never happened to me, and it just doesn't strike me as the way human nature generally operates. Also, the key to mastery is practice. If you hate practicing the violin, you'll probably never get good enough to enjoy it. She looked doubtful, but it was true. The sheer numbers of hours of deliberate training is the factor that distinguishes elite from lesser performers. Persistence is more important to mastery than innate ability, because the single most important element in developing an expertise is the willingness to practice. And while you can make a child practice, you can't make a child want to practice. On the flip side, although we often enjoy activities more when we're good at them, facility doesn't guarantee enjoyment, whether in work or play. In fact, being good at something can sometimes mask the fact that it's not enjoyable. I was very good at lawyerly work, which I suspect delayed my realization that I wanted a different career. Anyway, if you really want to play the violin, you could take lessons, I pointed out to her. I know adults who are learning to play instruments. Well, I'm not going to learn it now, she said dismissively. It's so easy to wish that we'd made an effort in the past so that we'd happily be enjoying the benefit now. But when now is the time when that effort must be made, as it always is, that prospect is much less inviting. Practicing builds discipline, another friend pointed out. If you don't like practicing, then it's an even better way to develop discipline. I'm very self-disciplined, and it's an exceedingly helpful quality to possess. But at the same time, I see the risks of self-discipline. I'm very good at making myself do things that I don't want to do, but sometimes I'm better off not doing those things at all. Self-discipline for the sake of self-discipline seems an arid pursuit. As Samuel Johnson observed, all severity that does not tend to increase good or prevent evil is idle. In any event, school was supplying Eliza with ample opportunities to develop that kind of self-regulation. Should home also impose the discipline of required study? I could see the value of piano lessons, but on the other hand, I was a passionate believer in the value of free time, especially for children, including time that appears fairly aimless. Philosopher Bertrand Russell recalled his childhood days. In solitude, I used to wander about the garden, alternately collecting birds' eggs and meditating on the flight of time. If I may judge by my own recollections, the important and formative impressions of childhood rise to consciousness only in fugitive moments in the midst of childish occupations and are never mentioned to adults. I think periods of browsing, during which no occupation is imposed from without, are important in youth because they give time for the formation of these apparently fugitive but really vital impressions. As an admittedly and quite possibly excessively type A parent, I wanted my daughters to use their time productively, but I also knew that valuable activities don't always appear valuable. Walter Murch, the Academy Award-winning film editor and sound designer, recalled, "I'm doing now at 58, almost exactly what most excited me when I was 11. But I went through a whole late adolescent phase when I thought, splicing sounds together can't be a real occupation. Maybe I should be a geologist or teach art history." One friend of mine continued to play with her dollhouse well into her teens, and now she's an interior decorator. Another friend spent time in law school guiltily playing video games, then left law to join a video game company. What was the waste of time? His video games or law school? Elizabeth once told me with a sigh, "I just wish I'd spent more time watching TV as a child." Because now she's a TV writer. As a child, I spent countless hours taking notes on what I read, copying passages into blank books, and illustrating these quotations with pictures clipped from magazines. Exactly the kind of work I do now on my website. Many people argue that children should be required to try many different kinds of activities to help them develop interests. But do those activities actually create new interests where ones don't already exist? Was there even a risk of squelching a budding interest by turning it from child-chosen play into a parent's assignment? As parents, we want our children to use their time fruitfully and to make choices that will make them happy, and we want to see them safely settled in the world. But I recognize that my desire to keep Eliza and Eleanor productive and safe could be dangerous. You're better off being a professor, lawyer, accountant, teacher, married, many parents advise. It's less risky. I know many people who started out on a safe, parent-approved track, only to leave it, voluntarily or involuntarily, after they'd spent a lot of time, effort, and money to pursue a course that had never attracted them. Now that I'm a parent, I marvel at the encouragement my own parents gave me when I decided to leave law to try to become a writer. It's painful to see your children risk failure or disappointment or pursue activities that seem like a waste of time, effort, and money. But we parents don't really know what's safe or a waste of time. So what should Jamie and I do? Insist on piano lessons or let Eliza skip them? Perhaps Eliza would enjoy playing the piano if we made her take lessons, or maybe not. And maybe she'd gain in self-discipline, or maybe not. But there was another critical factor to consider: opportunity cost. This term from economics describes the fact that making any particular choice means foregoing alternatives. Practicing the piano for an hour meant renouncing all the other activities that might otherwise be pursued. What would Eliza do with her time if she were unoccupied? She'd only know if we left her free to decide. The credential-hoarding, college admissions-minded part of me wanted to see Eliza accumulate accomplishments, but the wiser part of me argued that one of the most important lessons of childhood is discovering what you like to do. If before heading off to law school, I'd considered the activities that I'd always pursued in my free time, I might have started a career in writing sooner. I don't regret what I did. I had a wonderful time in law school and loved my brief time working as a lawyer. But my legal experience easily might have been much less satisfying, or I might never have mustered up the courage to try writing. As children or adults, when we're faced with unstructured time, with no obvious direction, no ready stimulation, and no assignments, we must choose our own occupations, a very instructive necessity. Growing up, I was bored out of my mind, a very creative friend recalled. As a consequence, I had an incredibly rich inner life. Yes, I replied, boredom can be important. That's when you have to figure out what you want to do. After a month of sporadic debate, Jamie and I decided to continue to guard our children's free time from ourselves. We wanted Eliza to be Eliza, even if that meant skipping piano lessons. We wanted her free hours at home to be an opportunity for exploration and choice. See the child you have, as the saying goes, not the child you wish you had. In the end, I agreed with Michel de Montaigne. The least strained and most natural ways of the soul are the most beautiful. The best occupations are the least forced. And what does Eliza do with her free time when she's set loose in the apartment? Does she play chess against herself, perform chemistry experiments, write sonnets, organize bake sales to benefit an animal shelter? No. She spends hours taking pictures and making videos of herself, then spends more hours reviewing them. Whether or not this is what I think she should do, it's what she does. Do you want to take a class about making videos, I asked? Editing techniques, special effects, all that? Why didn't you join the after-school club where they make stop-motion movies? No, Eliza shook her head. I don't want to have to learn along with a bunch of people. I like figuring it out myself and doing my own thing. Would you like to read a book about it? Sure, she said. I got her a book about making videos on a Mac, and also a book about Cindy Sherman. Suffer for 15 minutes. Routine doesn't deserve its bad reputation. It's true that novelty and challenge bring happiness, and that people who break their routines, try new things, and go to new places are happier. But routine can also bring happiness. The pleasure of doing the same thing in the same way every day shouldn't be overlooked. The things I do every day take on a certain beauty and provide a kind of invisible architecture to my life. Andy Warhol wrote, "Either once only or every day. If you do something once, it's exciting. And if you do it every day, it's exciting. But if you do it, say, twice or just almost every day, it's not good anymore." I wanted to harness the power of routine to accomplish some long procrastinated tasks. What I do almost every day matters more than what I do once in a while. My first splendid truth holds that to be happy, I need to think about feeling good, feeling bad, and feeling right in an atmosphere of growth. While many of my resolutions were meant to add more feeling good to my life, I decided to devote 15 minutes a day to rid myself of something that made me feel bad. 15 minutes. I could do anything for 15 minutes. I knew exactly what I wanted to tackle first. I'd been stewing about it ever since I worked on my shrine to my family in September. My failure to cope with our family photographs was a constant gnawing worry. I faithfully took photos and videos of our family, but I'd fallen far behind in turning them into a more permanent form. I'm a big believer in the importance of family photos. Recalling happy memories from the past gives a boost to happiness in the present, and looking at photographs of beloved people is an easy way to engineer a mood boost. Also, prompts like photo albums, mementos, and journals are excellent aids to memory. Looking at photographs helps people to recall memories more clearly, and also to remember much more than what's shown in the picture. I tend to forget huge swaths of the past, but looking at photographs helps me recall the little happy details that would otherwise be lost. When we were in Kansas City over the holidays, I'd arranged for a professional photographer to take our family photograph. It was expensive, but because family photographs are among my most precious possessions, this splurge gave me great bang for the happiness buck. Nevertheless, although I loved these high-quality heirloom photographs, the casual snapshots I took were just as important. They provided a kind of family diary, a record of our everyday life and its minor milestones and celebrations. I would never have imagined that I could forget Eliza's excitement in showing off her newly pierced ears, or Eleanor's toddler habit of constantly reaching for her belly button. Yet when I caught sight of these photos, I realized with alarm that my memories had already started to fade. I'd always loved family pictures, but the arrival of the digital camera had changed the way I dealt with them. With my old camera, I'd shoot a roll or two of film, drop it off at the photo shop, pick it up a few days later, and after I had a good stack, spend a few hours arranging photos in a photo album while watching TV. I ended up with some blurry photos and some red eye, but even so, I had wonderful albums. These days, digital cameras make it much easier to take and improve photos, but that was a curse as well as a blessing. I liked taking photographs, but turning them into permanent keepsakes now took a lot more effort. I used Shutterfly to make digital albums, and with that technology, I could eliminate red eye, crop, and write captions, which was wonderful, but it took time. And it wasn't time spent watching The Office reruns while mindlessly pasting in photos, as I used to do. It was time hunched in front of the computer, clicking and typing, just as I do all day long. Also, working on photo albums was satisfyingly manual. They were among the few things I created with my own hands. Manual occupations such as gardening, woodworking, cooking, doing home repairs, caring for pets, working on a car, or knitting can be deeply satisfying on many levels. The physical motion, the tangibility of the accomplishments, the pleasure of the tools, the sensory delights of the materials. Of course, to some people, these same activities counted as drudgery. Secret of adulthood? Just because something is fun for someone else doesn't mean it's fun for you, and vice versa. Even activities that are clearly highly creative, editing a video or designing a website, don't offer quite the same kind of tactile gratification. While activities so simple they hardly qualified as creative, building a fire or organizing a drawer, were deeply satisfying in this concrete way. I'd never been able to master anything as complicated as needlepoint, and I'd tried, But even I got satisfaction from handmade creations. As a child, I stuffed whole cloves into apples to make pomander balls by the dozens. And I labored over my blank books of illustrated quotations. In college, I handed out beaded bracelets to my friends. I'd enjoyed making the photo albums. Now, however, making an album meant more time in front of a screen, and as a result, I never felt like dealing with it. My camera and phone held an alarming backlog. Seeing rows of photographs that existed only in digital form made me anxious, because I worried that a computer crash or advancing technology could wipe them away. A physical album could be destroyed by fire or flood, but it somehow seemed safer. And it was certainly more fun to sit with my daughters and turn the pages of an album than it was to crowd around a screen and scroll through digital images. On the one hand, I wanted to make a lavish, lovely album, photographs carefully edited and arranged with lengthy, well-written captions to remind us, in future years, of all our adventures. But whenever I thought about the task of figuring out again how to turn hundreds of digital photos into albums, I felt desperate. I'd let so much time go by since the last album that I hardly knew where to start. I'd been promising myself that I'd organize an album in my free time, but the fact is, I never have any free time. I never wander aimlessly through the apartment looking for something to do. But making the album was a priority for me, so I wrote it on my calendar like a visit to the pediatrician. I would suffer for just 15 minutes a day. Starting January 1st, each afternoon, I set the timer on my phone for 15 minutes and doggedly used the time to work on my photos. I amused myself by changing the alarm sound every day. My favorite? Crickets. I wasn't going to plan how many days it would take to finish this job, because I knew that whatever I predicted, it would take longer. The planning fallacy describes the widespread psychological tendency to underestimate how long it will take to complete a task. Maybe it's an aspect of my all-or-nothing abstainer personality, but counterintuitively, I found that when I was trying to prod myself to do something, it came more easily when I did it every day. It was easier to post to my blog every day of the week than to post 3 days a week. Easier to go for a 20-minute walk every day rather than just some days. No debating today or tomorrow. Or do I get this day off? No excuses. As it turned out, making the album wasn't such an awful task once I actually got started. At first, it seemed very inefficient to work for such a short period. I spent the first 15 minutes just deleting unwanted photos from my camera. After I'd eliminated the photos I didn't want, I had to figure out how to upload the rest. For the next few sessions, by the time I figured out what I was supposed to be doing, the time was up, and I didn't allow myself to continue into minute 16. In the end, I used the Simple Path feature to arrange the pictures automatically. I hesitated before indulging in the shortcut, then repeated one of my favorite secrets of adulthood, cribbed from Voltaire. Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. My desire to create the perfect photo album was preventing me from working on one at all. I should do a good enough job and get it done. I didn't write captions, I didn't crop, I didn't do a lot of things that would have improved the pictures, but I got the job done. I was finally completely up to date, and I finished 2 huge albums. Ah, the thrill of finally pushing order album. Once those albums arrived in the mail, I tackled the next phase of the project by handwriting captions for the photos. This took several sittings, but at last I finished. My handwriting was messy, and I could have written longer, more interesting captions, but I'd finished. I felt an enormous sense of relief. Now that I was caught up, how could I prevent myself from getting buried under photographs again? I flipped forward a few months in my calendar and made a note on the day we were scheduled to return from spring break. Make a new photo album. Once the albums were safely on the shelf, I experienced a phenomenon that I'd noticed over and over with my happiness project. Completing one challenging task supplies the energy to tackle another challenging task. After the photos were under control, I turned to the confusing jumble of our family videos, which were stored on outdated miniature cassette tapes and discs. Dealing with the tapes required me to do nothing more than pay, a lot, to have them transferred to DVDs, but I'd procrastinated for years about doing even that.